I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Andrew Rosen, co-founder of Theory, a contemporary clothing company initially for young professional women. Andrew launched Theory in 1997 with his partner Ellie Tahari, using Lycra as a breakthrough stretch fabric that they incorporated into the company's clothes. Andrew is considered one of the pioneers in the American fashion industry, investing in and mentoring other fashion companies such as Alice and Olivia and Rag & Bone, among others. Welcome.
Thank you. A lot of other companies, too, but a pioneer, I don't know. Maybe we could say that about my grandfather and my father.
Which is exactly where I want to start. Your grandfather was Arthur, and he came from Russia.
Yeah.
And he started the Puritan Dress Company in 1910, which basically launched your whole family's lives into the fashion world. He was known, he was a good garment cutter. What exactly is a garment cutter?
My grandfather started in the cutting room. The cutting room is the place where fabrics are laid out and the pattern pieces of the dresses are laid on top, and he cut out the patterns, cut out the pieces. Today, it's all done by machinery, but back then it was done by hand, and the precision of how it was done, the speed in which it was done, like anything else, there are those that are more skilled than others.
The company he founded in 1910 in Waltham, Massachusetts, was called the Puritan Dress Company. I kept thinking as I was learning about you that I'd love to see some of his dresses. And, you know, what goes around comes around. And while it might have been out of style for the last 100 years, there might be a reemergence of a Puritan dress. I mean, there's this bohemian aesthetic. And
you know, I'm not very nostalgic in that way. And so my father never kept any, or I never kept her. You know, I think that maybe my attitude is more always looking to the future instead of dwelling on the past. I don't know whether I ever saw any of the clothes, but he was making and selling at retail dresses for $2.99, $3.99. That's $2.99, $3.99. You know, it was a very different time and a very different era. But as I look back and see clothes in the 1900s and early and mid-1900s, they're very inspiring.
So your father, Carl, took over the business from Arthur, or worked together with his father. And I feel like the company, Puritan Dress Company, which became Puritan Fashions, kind of was an innovator. It had mini skirts in the 1960s, even cocktail dresses before then, the Gloria Swanson. Can you speak to that, like that forward-leaning posture?
You know, my dad was always sort of very innovative in terms of what he did and how he did it. He was very flamboyant, and he was the first one. He used to buy designs from the famous French designers and bring them back and recreate them here. He did a deal with Gloria Swanson. He did a deal with Chris Everett to make tennis clothes. And ultimately, the big deal he did in designer jeans with Calvin Klein in the mid-1970s. So my father was always sort of innovating things and trying to evolve and change the way people dressed and looked at fashion. That was always about my early life. I remember him doing a deal with the Beatles, and we'd have all these Beatle t-shirts and Beatle hats and everything back in the 1960s.
And you mentioned that, you know, he was innovative and constantly evolving. It seems like he was like that in his personal life, too. Can you speak to his kind of personality outside of work?
He was a lot flashier than I was. You know, fancy cars, maybe even a little fancier dressed. I'm a little more low-key. But he just was larger than life and, you know, a character that sort of we rarely see today. And I think maybe it went with the times. And he was an incredible person and a great father to me and such a great friend to so many people. And my dad has passed away 35 years now, but there would be frequently people come up to me and say, oh, I remember your dad, or your dad did this, or, you know, it's really nice to have that memory and that legacy. Even though I lost my dad when I was relatively young.
In your 20s,
I miss him, but there was never an empty feeling. He stayed with me in my life for all these years. And I think part of it is that obviously I followed in an industry after him. I also am very interested in thoroughbred racing and breeding, which was also a passion of my dad's. And although I do think I'm quite different than my dad, a lot of my interests and a lot of my way of thinking and so on, you know, it comes from the same place.
There's very little rebellion on your part, it seems.
I was not a rebellious child at all. Mm-hmm. I was the youngest of four children, and I guess I was always sort of hanging around my mom and dad, and, you know, they'd have to take me on trips and so on. My next sister is 3 years older than me, so I was sort of the baby that was always maybe a little special. Rebellion was not part of anything I thought or whatever.
What about your mother?
My mother was a really fantastic woman, very different than my dad in sort of way. She was pretty private, but very eccentric and very creative. And I sort of picked up from my mom this whole love of the garden and landscaping and the outdoors and so on. A lot of that is what I love to do at my home in Southampton or here in New York, as I'm sort of a serial landscaper that way that I got from my mom. But my mom was very stylish and, you know, had a great sense of style both in her homes and in the way she dressed, and, you know, was really a terrific lady. She passed away now 3 years ago, and, you know, up until the time she passed away, I used to speak to her three times a week. And
what's her name?
Shirley Rosen. In fact, all of my codes on all, you know, you now need to have codes on everything, is the year my mother was born.
Oh.
So I always can remember her.
Now I know what to type in on your ATM ATM machine. Instinctively, you were drinking up the fashion industry just by being around your father and your grandfather. What are some of your most prominent memories of, you know, being with him at work?
You know, even before I went to work, I remember running around my grandfather's dress factory in Waltham and going through the dresses and just experiencing sort of that whole factory part of the business. I remember my dad bringing clothes home and us rummaging through them. And I also remember when I was young, my dad would always have business people over to the house and just sitting there and observing and not really understanding what was going on, but just soaking it all in, so to speak. So it's true, like from an early age, and I don't think my dad never wanted me or ever said anything about me going into the business to follow him. In fact, he said quite the opposite.
There was some flirtation with becoming a professional golf player. You dropped out of college. You went to the University of Miami?
Yeah, I went to the University of Miami and a college in Palm Springs, California, basically to play a lot of golf.
Was there a pivot moment or a turning point where you said, okay, I'm leaving and I'm joining the business?
It was actually my uncle who said to me one day, I was playing golf with my uncle in California, and that's all, basically what I was doing was playing golf. I was 19 years old, and my uncle said to me, when are you going to get serious and go to work for your father and stop playing golf every day? That's sort of how that happened. My dad sort of put together an interesting career for me because I started working in a knitting mill in Long Island. And from there, I went to a dress factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and sort of got to see the industry from an angle that people wouldn't get the opportunity to see today and very rarely, and learned sort of the way everything worked from the inside out. And, you know, was able to spend time on the sewing floor with the pattern makers, with the cutters, in the warehouse, with the shipping, and really, you know, understand technically a lot of not only what happens there, but how those people think and how to relate to them. And so I spent like a year and a half doing that, and then I came to New York, and it was at the time that my dad had done the deal with Calvin Klein, and came to New York and worked in the showroom just as a sales assistant, really, or a salesperson. It was one of the, you know, most revolutionary things that happened back in the 1970s and with the Brooke Shields commercial and all that kind of thing. And so it was just an amazing experience and exposure.
I want to speak more about this. Jeans was the sea-changing agent for the business in a way. Puritan did a licensing deal with Calvin Klein that really caused the company's profits to escalate. Can you speak about that?
Yeah. My dad had a company that in the 1970s was doing around $300 million in sales. And every year it would eke out a small profit and was made up of 10 different dress companies and a lot of factories all over the U.S. and, you know, lots of employees and so on. And, you know, it was a good living and a good business, but it wasn't anything special. But in 1976, he did this deal with Calvin Klein. And I think 1977, we started shipping the first jeans. And within 3 years, my dad had closed down every single business he had, went from like 4,000 employees to 800 employees, no more manufacturing facilities or anything, and had a company that was doing the same $300 million in sales and making 10 times the profit he was making the other way. And interestingly enough, and my dad said it to me then, and it never registered, and recently it did, is that, you know, he said to me, you're at the forefront of a whole new revolution in our industry, designer labeled apparel. Before that, their designer identified apparel was not really what was going on in American fashion. Calvin Klein and then Ralph Lauren and so on were really the pioneers of designers having their own label and owning their own business. It really wasn't like that before. It's people like my father that controlled the business. And so I, as I say, I never really appreciated or registered with me. And maybe, I think 4 or 5 years ago, I sort of said, yeah, now I remember my dad saying that. He was right.
In 1982, he got what kind of cancer?
My dad had kidney cancer, but he never stopped working till really, really the very end. And really spent as much time as he could preparing me for something that, I mean, frankly, I didn't understand at the time, but was virtually, you know, a very difficult and impossible situation to prepare me for.
So you were 26 when you took over the company. Barry Schwartz and a Calvin Klein, they bought your company, they bought Puritan in a hostile takeover. And you were there for a few years. And then you spent time at Anne Klein as the CEO and divorced from them. But then in 1997, is sort of like this new era where theory was born. Could you tell me about your encounter with Eli Tahari, who was ultimately your co-founder?
I mean, I could sort of tell you a little bit about, you know, even the events that happened before that. I'm very open about my career, and I don't believe that success is just a straight line of accomplishments. You know, my dad passing and having to take over the company and ultimately Barry and Calvin buying the company ended up being a good thing. And I stayed on and worked for Barry and Calvin for 4 or 5 years. And, you know, I actually was going to leave very shortly thereafter. And I had got a job to run one of Ralph Lauren's businesses. And I went to the guy that they had brought in to run the company. And I said to him, you know, I'm gonna leave. I got this job opportunity. And he turned to me and he said, no, you're not going to go anywhere. You're going to stay here with me. You're one of the best things we have here. And you're going to run this company again one day. And I looked at him and I said, are you sure? Have you been reading the press? And he said, you're going to stay with me and work together with me. And I stayed, and ultimately I was promoted to running the company again. And I think when that happened, I sort of had a different point of view and said to myself, I don't have anything more to accomplish here. And, you know, maybe in some ways I wanted to just prove that my dad was right and those guys were wrong. And I left the company And interesting enough, I'm still very close friends with Barry Schwartz. And when I see Calvin, Calvin and I have a very nice relationship. Anyway, then I got offered the job to be the CEO of Anne Klein. I had known the fellow that was the part owner of the company. Part owner of the company was an American guy, and another guy was Japanese. It was sort of an introduction to what ended up happening in the rest of my life. It was a way that I could get disconnected from my family's business and sort of have something that was more my own. And I was there for 6 years, and I suppose that I had a desire to move the company in a different direction. So we had a disagreement, and they fired me. It didn't feel really very good at the moment. You know, I didn't really appreciate it. But the truth of the matter is that it wasn't the right job for me anymore. And I went off to really pursue something that was much more authentic to me and to create something that was really my own expression.
You started Theory in 1997. Eli Tahari was your partner at the time, and he introduced you to a new material, which really was the material upon which a lot of the company was based. It's Lycra, which is elastic polyurethane, actually. Can you tell me about Lycra and what the appeal was for you?
I actually met Eli Tahari because when I had left Anne Klein, I had the idea that I wanted to start something on my own, but I didn't know what it was. And then I met Eli. I was just coming in and advising Eli on his clothing and his marketing and his merchandising. And he and I got along really great. We understood each other. And Eli and I decided to start this business. And at that time, he was experimenting with a lot of fabrics with Lycra. And he had actually made me a pair of pants. I put the pants on and I said, Eli, this is the business we're going into. Basically, I wanted to have a company that 100% of its clothes were made with fabrics with Lycra. And I had this idea that the world was changing. It was just at the beginning of cell phones and the internet, and that the office was going to be a much more versatile place. It wasn't going to be a destination anymore. It's going to be wherever you were, and that people needed clothes that were much more versatile than that weren't so uniformed. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make a whole line of clothes out of fabric with Lycra. I wanted them to be individual pieces that could mix and match in a multitude of different ways, and that could be comfortable yet sexy and modern and have a whole different shape and proportion.
Why, incidentally, did you name it Theory?
Basically, I was originally going to start the company and call it Stretch Theory, and came to my senses and realized that maybe Stretch Theory was a little limiting just wanted to make it Theory. The interesting thing there is that somebody else had the name registered, and I happened to know him. I called him on the phone and said, listen, I want to get this name Theory. I don't see you using it. He said, why don't you come over and see me? Anyway, make a long story short, he said, if you give my wife and daughter some free clothes, I'd be happy to give you the name for what it cost me to register it.
And you should know, in 1997 when you started, I was a recent college graduate, and I would go into your store in Columbus Avenue on the Upper West Side.
Right.
The clothes were way too expensive for me, but when I could afford a piece, they were my favorite pieces.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
It's funny that you mentioned the store on Columbus Avenue. My daughter was a teenager at that time, and I remember she was having a bad night, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I said, oh, come on, Ashley, I want to take you and show you the store I want to take on Madison Avenue. And I showed her the store on Madison. She said, Dad, why are you taking the store on Madison? I want to show you the store on Columbus Avenue. And so that's how I ended up taking the store, because, you know, my daughter had
Ashley
pointed it out to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, my personal life and my business life were totally intertwined at that time. I was raising my kids and started the company at the same time, and so my kids had to sort of put up with a lot.
What else did they have to put up with, or contributions did they make?
I got a CFDA award a few years ago, and my kids narrated a video about, you know, their perception of their father, and, you know, I remember my son having to say, and daughter, well, we used to spend our Saturdays and Sundays walking through factories or retail stores. And but, you know, neither one of them ended up in the business. But I think it was a good education for them to understand what it takes to sort of really love something and be passionate about it and be committed to it. And, you know, both my kids are committed to what they're doing in life today.
Which is?
My daughter's a professional CrossFit competitor, and my son is in the music industry. She sort of does what I do, but in the music industry.
Which is find good talent and support them.
Yes.
So you launched Theory with Ellie with this Lycra component and wanting to make contemporary clothes for really young women at the time. At what point did you get a sense that, you know what, this is getting traction?
I think that starting out, I was always a little nervous, would this really work? You know, I remember waking up in the middle of the night on many occasions and walking around, how's this all going to come together and work? But pretty quickly, the reaction to the clothes was unusual. Although I wasn't confident I was going to stay in business, I was confident I had a business really right away. The first year we did about $6 million in business. The second year we did $20 million in business. Once that happened, I sort of knew that there was a future, a big future here, and the response to the clothes was enough. I didn't need advertising or anything. The clothes were the best advertisement for our company.
And did you start with retail stores, or just walk me through the first year or two?
You know, it was a very different environment back then. The idea of going directly to the consumer was not something that manufacturers or designers thought about. You know, the business at that time was done through, you know, major department and specialty stores, and we sold all of the best ones. And it was a much more traditional way of starting a business and done through department stores, and it gave me the ability to, without a huge investment, be able to scale the business really quickly.
And incidentally, the industry, you alluded to this, was a lot different than it is now, you know, in the 2000s. Can you speak as to, like, what some of those differences were? How you'd have to go and check out inventory yourself physically, or can you talk to us about, like, what that landscape was?
In those days, we didn't have the robust digital computer support that we have today. I mean, Well, e-commerce didn't exist. The internet was just at the beginning. Computers did not have the capabilities or dimension to think the way they do now and be a part of the business. So a lot of it was done by feel, and a lot of it was done from much of the things that I had learned and working in the factories for my dad, or sitting at a conference table listening to my dad.
Like what?
You know, just understanding how to get clothes made. You know, in those days, I was manufacturing most of my clothes in New York City, and right. I had to find great manufacturing. In the beginning, that, you know, making 1,000 pair of pants was easy, but when you had to make 20,000 pair or 50,000 pair, you know, that became a little more complicated.
You were acquired by a Japanese company in 2003 called Fast Retailing, or Link Holdings is their subsidiary. I think that the name and also the font that's used is reflective of the simplicity of and the cleanliness of the fashion, of the design. Japanese aesthetic is kind of reflective of, you know, like this simple vibe. Like, what is it about the Japanese? Was it just coincidence that a Japanese company was interested in you?
Well, as I told you, back in 1989, when I went to work for Anne Klein, one of the owners of Anne Klein was Japanese. He had a very close friend of his who was actually sort of a mentee of his that was Japanese. His name was Ricky Sasaki, and Ricky and I became really close friends when I was working at Anne Klein. And when I left Anne Klein, Ricky was very supportive of me and helpful of me. And he was Japanese, living in Hong Kong, had a big manufacturing business over there and so on, and was really supportive of me, not financially, sort of emotionally in terms of what I was going through and so on. Ricky sort of, you know, helped me through that. And then Ricky, when 1997 China and Hong Kong merged, Ricky had some financial trouble in Hong Kong and needed to get out of Hong Kong, had $1 million left, went back to Japan and said, I want to start Theory in Japan. This was 1998. I said to Ricky, Ricky, go ahead, start Theory in Japan. Don't worry about paying me royalties or anything else. Just start your business, concentrate, use all your money to make your business work, and we'll catch up later. As we were building a business in the U.S., Ricky was building his business in Japan. Mm-hmm. It was a separate company, a licensee, and that ultimately was the company in 2003 mm-hmm. That bought Theory and partnered with Fast Retailing to get the money. So Fast Retailing put up the money to buy the company, and Ricky and Misty and I became partners.
Isn't it just lovely how happenstance, how life kind of takes these accidental turns, right?
Yeah, well, you never know when or where you're meeting someone that's going to change your life. The question is to be open and available and curious enough to be able to explore them. And, you know, I think one of the things about me is I am very curious and I am open-minded. I mean, frankly, I met my wife because I was open-minded and curious in that.
Jenny Dyer.
Yeah, my wife sent me an email and wanted some advice on, she had a fashion company in England and sent me an email just out of the blue. And I said to my assistant, set up a date with her. Mm. And, you know, part of that was what I learned from my dad, too. You know, you never know where the next good idea is coming from. And so anyway, I set up a date. It was a date in my office. And that's how I met Jenny. And you know, sort of the rest is history there.
You seem to have kind of like a Buddhist mentality about things. You keep saying, well, just when you think your luck is down, it actually might not be, you know, an unauspicious moment. And like, did you grow up in a deeply religious household? I mean, your family is Jewish?
Or yes.
Was there any of that at play?
Not at all.
Yeah, but am I right in my interpretation of how you...
I just think that I have a way about me that always tends to look at the opportunity, not the negative side of things. And I've always been that way ever since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of that was my mother's influence. And I think that I sort of was lucky to get the best of my mother and the best of my father. And I think it's just the way I am.
Do you wish your dad could see what you've built?
It's an interesting thing because I was at my back doctor the other day, and my back doctor was talking about medians and that he went to a median.
A median?
A median is a psychic.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
And anyway, I was thinking to myself, oh, it would be great if I could go to a median and I could speak to my father. I don't think of things and, well, my dad would be proud of me or anything like that. I think at the end of the day, I have to be satisfied and fulfilled with what I'm doing. And, you know, my motivation is to really do the right thing and to be authentic to who I am and what I believe in.
What might I not know about you if you don't tell me? Just even in like your mundane life, like the foods you like to eat or what you do, you have daily ritual with your family?
The thing about me is I like a routine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is, my wife was a great force in my life because she gave me a lot of grounding. You know, in some ways I can wander around and do lots of different things and get pulled in lots of different directions because I am very curious and I am sort of very available and accessible. And sometimes I, you know, maybe take on a little more than what I should. And, you know, I like a routine.
So what does it look like?
Monday through Friday, I work really hard. Mm-hmm. My focus is on that. And
what about exercise? Like when you say routine?
I exercise every morning at 7:30.
What do you do?
2 days a week, I do yoga, and 3 days a week in the gym, mm-hmm. All in my my house. Before that, I get up and I sort of go through all my horse racing stuff, speak to my trainers in England or my trainers in America, because horse racing happens really early. So I do all my horse racing stuff early and go to the gym and mm-hmm. get ready for work. And when I'm finished with work, work is gone. There's no mm-hmm. more work. I have a lot of outside interests. I love to play golf, and I play golf every Friday, Saturday, Sunday in the summer, and frequently after the golf, I come home to the house, have lunch with my wife and all, and then I go fishing. And I love to fish, and I have a couple of ponds on the property, feed the fish, and just have a really nice sort of serene life for the weekend. Then I can be sort of fresh for the week, but I don't start thinking about work really until sometimes Sunday night, most of the time Monday morning.
It's striking that you're so plugged in during the week, and that the things that appeal to you outside of your professional life are actually not static, but golf. God, I can't think of a slower game, or fishing, or gardening. What is the appeal of horse racing?
You know, that was...
How many horses do you have?
60-some, 62 or 3. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like fashion. It's, you know, I breed horses and race them and sell them, buy them. It's sort of the idea of trying to find the next winner, you know, the next good item. It's very much like that, you know, finding a good horse. You got to work really hard to find them.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, well, we've got through the hour. You didn't even get half the stuff on your list. Thank you.
My guest has been Andrew Rosen, co-founder of Theory. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.